Welcome to Medication Talk, the official podcast of TRC Healthcare, home of Pharmacist Letter, Prescriber's Letter, RX Advanced, and the most trusted clinical resources. On today's episode, we'll listen in as our expert panel reviews flu vaccine recommendations for the 2023-2024 influenza season. Our guests today are Dr. Lauren B. Angelo from the Rosalind Franklin University of Medicine and Science and Dr. Kelly R. Good from the Virginia Commonwealth University School of Pharmacy. You'll also hear practical advice from panelists on TRC's editorial advisory board. Dr. Reed Blackwelder from East Tennessee State University, Dr. Stephen Carrick from the USC School of Medicine Greenville, Dr. Andrea Darby Stewart from the University of Arizona College of Medicine Phoenix, Dr. Anthony Donato from the Tower Health System, and Dr. Douglas Powell from the University of Washington School of Medicine. This podcast is an extract from TRC's Emerging Recommendations panel webinar. Each month, experts and frontline providers discuss current medication therapy topics and practical recommendations to include in TRC's letter articles. The full webinar originally aired on August 21st, 2023.
And now, the CE information.
This podcast offers continuing education credit for pharmacists, physicians, and nurses. Please log into your pharmacist letter or prescriber's letter account and look for the title of this podcast in the list of available CE courses. For the purposes of disclosure, Dr. Angelo reports relevant financial relationships by receiving an honorarium from Moderna and participating on a speaker's bureau for Pfizer. Dr. Good reports relevant financial relationships by receiving an honorarium from Merck, Pfizer, Sanofi, and Valneva. The other speakers you'll hear have nothing to disclose. All relevant financial relationships have been mitigated. Now, let's join TRC editor Dr. Sarah Clockers and start our discussion.
Our first article reads, you'll play a key role in optimizing flu vaccines for 2023-2024. So Kelly, we're hoping you can get us started and give us a brief overview of the big changes to the flu vaccines for this season, and then comment on the flu composition this season and how it may differ from last season.
Yes, thank you, Sarah. So all flu vaccines this year will still be quadrivalent. We do have one slight change in the influenza vaccine composition for the H1N1, you know, the quadrivalent, your two A's and two B's, so H1N1, H3N2. In H1N1, it's still going to be the Victoria sort of virus for the egg-based vaccines in the Wisconsin. But you remember when we name our A, it's the A, it's where the strain was first discovered, the strain number, and then the year it was discovered. So that it has been updated a little bit, but it's still the A strain that was found in Victoria and the A strain that was found in Wisconsin. But all vaccines will continue to be quadrivalent for this season of 2023-24.
Thank you for that. So just one minor change. Hopefully they'll be effective. And we'll get to that in a few minutes. But first, can you comment on the updated CDC recommendations for vaccinating people with an egg allergy? So this was the other main change. We had some questions about screening for egg allergies. Do we still need to do that? And then the other question that we had a lot of was the observation period. So there was a little bit of confusion around that. So can you comment on the changes coming around egg allergy?
Yes. So as you've noticed over the last few years, some of the recommendations around egg allergy and influenza vaccines have sort of changed or loosened up. And this year they did a real analysis of the reports to VAERS, as well as the egg content of the influenza vaccine and the percent of population that has egg allergies, and what reports were for anaphylaxis to the vaccine adverse event reporting system. And so the ACIP has made a recommendation now that all person age 6 months with egg allergy should receive influenza vaccine unless another contraindication exists. And so we're still going to screen according to best practices for all allergies, and we're going to be prepared for an allergic reaction just like we would be prepared for any vaccine. But any influenza vaccine for a patient with egg allergy is appropriate as long as you're looking at the recipient's age, health status, can be used. So you can either use a vaccine that might have some egg content or egg protein, or you might be able to still use the egg free vaccines, the cell cultured and the recombinant vaccine for someone with egg allergy if they'd prefer to get that. And we're no longer limited to a setting where people, a more medical setting than perhaps a pharmacy, but everybody should be following those best practices to take care of an adverse reaction for any vaccine. And so that's what pharmacists would be expected to do, or any healthcare provider in administering influenza vaccine this year.
Thank you for reviewing all of that. Another question that comes up is, and you mentioned that the CDC did a thorough review. How often, Kelly, do we see a patient with a history of egg allergy have a reaction to the flu vaccine? And how does that compare into the general population having, you know, a bad reaction?
Yeah, so if you look at it, the VAERS reports is what they've looked at. So from 2017 to 2022, there were 178 anaphylaxis reports after an inactivated influenza vaccine. And of those, 18 people had egg allergy. So you can have, you know, a reaction to a flu vaccine that's not because you have egg allergy, but you might have another reason to have anaphylaxis to the vaccine. So it's very, when we look at egg allergy affecting the population, it's about 1.3% of all children and about 0.2% of all adults. A lot of children outgrow that. It's usually associated with atopy and asthma in a younger child. So we don't really see a much increase in those reactions compared to the general population.
Excellent. Thank you. And another question we're getting is, we got it actually a few times from our reviewers, is why do we still have egg-free vaccine options? And so these options are still available and folks are wondering when to use them. And so are these an option for patients who've had anaphylaxis to a prior egg-containing flu vaccine? Or if someone's had anaphylaxis to a prior flu vaccine, should we avoid all flu vaccines in that scenario?
So if a person has had a prior anaphylactic reaction to an influenza vaccine, we would not re-administer that influenza vaccine. So we want to make, because we don't know why, what was the cause of anaphylaxis. The Flucelvax and Flublok were really created, there's a couple reasons, right? So it's based on egg allergy and sort of our recommendations from ACIP. We're a little bit stricter around eggs. You know, when I first started doing flu vaccines, we didn't do if somebody had egg allergy, we didn't give them a flu vaccine at all. And so we've seen the recommendations, as we know, and science gets better. But the other thing about these two vaccines is they're made a little bit differently. We're not relying on the chicken eggs or the hen eggs to grow the strains and be able to produce the vaccine. So these vaccines can be spooled up much faster, and the Flucelvax and Flublok can be made much quicker than waiting on that 6 months for the vaccine. And so that's why we see that we have vaccines earlier in our practices than we would have before. And so when we think about that, these are still appropriate. Flucelvax is now down to 6 months, so it can be an option for children up through adults. And then the Flublok is 18 and over. And actually, Flublok now has a preferential recommendation for people 65 years and over. So it also has a role in that population, even though it is considered to be egg-free.
Yes, excellent. Thank you for that information. Andrea, how are you discussing the egg allergy with your patients?
Yeah, I mean, the American Academy of Allergy and Immunology has said that we don't need to worry about this since about 2019. So I've been trying to have these conversations. Unfortunately, everybody's consent forms, you know, have big bold writing, do not administer if there's an egg allergy. So I talk with my patients about this. I reassure them. Most people will believe me. Some have to go to their allergy office and get confirmation, and then they'll come back or they'll get taken care of at that office for those allergists that are still supplying them for those who have significant egg allergies, just for out of a sense of reassurance. But basically, I'm just trying to help re-educate people. Unfortunately, this is going to become one of those myths in medicine, I think, that we have to deal with probably for the next decade.
I agree. Reed, did you have something to add to the conversation? I see you chatting.
Yeah, well, I think Andrew's point is so on target. Medical myths are fascinating, but this is something that is so ingrained if I'm trying to say to a patient, there's really not a risk, and yet my consent form has it written down, that's going to be a problem. So I would mention in the article that it would be very appropriate to consider changing your consent forms and just removing it. Otherwise, you're going to really create a bit of cognitive dissonance.
That's a good point. Doug?
Yeah, it's one of my favorite topics is medical myths. And the landmark article came out in 2014, so almost 10 years later, the CDC is coming out and saying what we've known. Yeah, certainly the allergists have known for a long time. And I think the world's divided into people who react to things and people who don't. And the egg allergy piece got sort of woven into this, and just without data, with the biggest article is like 4,800 individuals with egg allergy getting influenza vaccine with no episodes of anaphylaxis related to it. And I agree totally with Reed. It really, we lose credibility when we ask about egg allergy and then we ignore it. Mm-hmm. So I'm all for getting rid of asking about it and then treating it like was mentioned. Yes, anybody could potentially have a reaction to a vaccine. They're very uncommon, and be prepared for that. But this egg allergy group is really not at significantly higher risk.
Mm-hmm. And the other piece with that too is the package labeling. Not all package labels are updated. So that's another, you know, concern as well. And it's hard to, you know, talk someone into that if it's in all these other places. So excellent discussion on the main changes this season. So let's just dive in and talk about a few of the general vaccine recommendations. Lauren, I'm wondering if you could comment on what flu season's expected to look like this season. When is it expected to peak with all the other respiratory viruses going around? Would love your perspective on that.
Sure. Thanks, Sarah. Well, I think with COVID, it has made watching and tracking respiratory viruses a bit more challenging. I know we had one year when COVID was first upon us, where flu rates were very low, in fact, so low, and the CDC looks at some of that tracking, they really didn't have enough numbers to make any strong conclusions about that year. And then I think it was last year, we had our peak as we would typically see it, and then we had an uptick again later in the spring, which was unexpected. So I think as we're going into this year, it is a little bit difficult to predict. Cases start to pop up around this time of year. If we're in a typical year, we're going to see cases, you know, really start to take hold in the winter months. So when we're into November, December, and that peak is typically in January and February. But again, it's so hard to know. So it's just important to be vaccinating earlier on. The other interesting, numbers to watch are from Australia. So they're opposite of us. And so they're just wrapping up their flu season. And I was just checking, you know, what was going on with them. And they've had a rough year. Their winter months were a bit of a challenge this year with flu, hitting some of their closing in on some of their record highs. Children were impacted more than in previous years. So I think these are just things to watch as we move into our fall and winter months.
Mm-hmm. Great. And we do say in our article to vaccinate now. So this will go to press and be our September issue. So ideally in September or October, and continue as long as flu is circulating. What are your thoughts on that wording? Or would you edit it and just leave it vaccinate now if someone comes in?
Now gave me pause. I know I've seen the flu signs everywhere as I'm driving around the city of Chicago. But really, if you look at the CDC guidance, those to be vaccinated in August is a smaller number. The majority of our patients, the CDC is advising that we wait until September, October, because we really want that flu vaccine to last the duration of our flu season. And so getting it on board too soon might be doing a disservice to our patients. So when we say now at publication date, which would be September, that would be accurate. But I would be careful vaccinating most of our patients too soon.
Okay. And then we have a question from the audience kind of on this topic. Should anyone wait until later in the season? So would you ever recommend somebody wait till after October to get their flu vaccine?
No, I don't think we have any guidance as to needing to do that. You know, I would say if we can get everyone vaccinated before the end of October, that's really our goal, because we don't know what the season's going to do and when cases are going to peak. So I think just sticking within the September, October months is really what we need to be doing.
Okay, great. That's super helpful for our wording. And then quick question too. When should we stop giving them?
when you run out of vaccine.
There you go.
Vaccines have expired. Yeah, please don't use expired vaccine. But, you know, most of our supplies and the dating will last us, you know, through the spring months. And so, again, as we saw, I think it was a year ago, that uptick in the spring. So it's important to keep vaccinating anyone who hasn't yet been vaccinated, even if we're into, you know, March, April, May.
Okay, good. That is super helpful. And then can you comment on how effective you flu vaccines are expected to be this season? That's always a question we get, and I'm always like, let's predict.
Well, the reason, as Kelly mentioned, they changed the H1N1 component because we saw that was the predominant strain that was circulating last year. And even in Australia, I think they were hit pretty hard with that. And so hopefully, you know, by changing what's in that vaccine will help target that. But when we look at just in general, our flu seasons, the CDC will report out anywhere from 40% to 60%. It's so hard to really target what that's going to be moving forward. We hope on the higher end of that, but sometimes when we see those H3 and 2 seasons as the predominant seasons, those vaccines tend to be less effective. And the other thing I'll add is we're dealing with respiratory viruses. It is really hard when we talk about vaccination to just overall prevent the virus from entering our bodies. What we're trying to do is prevent us from getting really sick, ending up in the hospital, ending up with significant morbidity or mortality from these. And so, as we look at effectiveness, we're talking not just preventing flu, but preventing getting really sick from the flu as well.
Okay. In our article, we say to explain that people given last year's flu vaccine were about 40 to 70% less likely to be hospitalized for influenza. Do you think that stat works better, or should we stick with the 40 to 60%, the usual?
Well, yeah, they're not that much different. I'd be curious what others on the panel think about that. But I think, you know, when we talk about even COVID and RSV, we have shifted that conversation a little bit to keeping people out of the hospital and keeping people from getting really sick. So it's an important number to share. But when it's not that much different from actually getting the flu is what the CDC has been reporting out, I think tailor the conversation to what your patient's concerns are, who's in front of you, and what their risks are.
Okay, that's a good point.
Just as we talk about kind of numbers for patients, I think we run a little bit of a risk that, you know, everybody thinks that if they get the flu shot, they're not going to get the flu. If they got the flu and they had a flu shot, that somehow things were failed. I just think we need to be, I would love to be able to be a little bit more accurate in how we put this for patients so that we don't set ourselves up for this concept of failure every season. And I don't have a good answer for it. Would love to invite commentary on that, but it's definitely a challenge.
Yes, Stephen, how do you discuss the benefits of flu vaccines with your patients?
Oh yeah, I mean, it's very much individualized. I would definitely try to remind them of some of the data you guys presented. I mean, this is really a vaccine that's intended to prevent you from getting so sick and be hospitalized. It may help reduce the duration of symptoms or the intensity of the symptoms. It's a great way to protect you and your family from getting really sick, protect your loved ones from getting sick. But I still think there's just this persistence of, I don't know if it's misinformation that's on social media or the lay media, or it's just it's a belief that the flu vaccine is going to prevent you from getting the flu. And I just try to sort of say that, no, that's not likely. What we really want to do is make sure that if you were to encounter it, to be have less symptoms, shorter symptoms, not be hospitalized, and hopefully it'll just be a minor sort of viral URI type course.
Okay. And so the recommendations haven't changed. So any age-appropriate flu vaccine for everyone 6 months and older, and the recommendations for flu mist haven't changed, keeping that in mind for healthy non-pregnant patients ages 2 through 49. And I just wanted to reiterate and spend a little time before we have to move on the vaccines for patients 65 and over. So which vaccines are preferred in this age group? And do you recommend one over the other? What do you do if you don't have one available and you have a patient in your pharmacy? Lauren, can you answer that question for
us? Yeah, thank you for asking, because this was a recent change. It wasn't with this year's recommendations, but I believe it was last year's, where the ACIP, the Advisory Committee on Immunization Practices, came out with a preferential recommendation. So we hadn't seen that yet for flu vaccines. We'd all been wondering about it and if it was ever going to happen. And so they finally had enough data to review, who's most impacted by this in that age group and what vaccines seem to be most effective, again, at keeping people from getting really sick, keeping people out of the hospital. And so the recommendation, as we see here, it's either an adjuvanted vaccine or one of our higher dose vaccines. So as you see on the slide, the Fluad is going to be your adjuvanted, and then both Flublok and Fluzone High Dose are considered our higher dose vaccine. So all three of these are viable options for your 65 years and older. Flublok has been available for ages 18 and older, but because it has three times the antigen as our standard dose influenza vaccines, it has shown some promise in our older patients. And so these are great choices. Now, you did ask, Sarah, if we don't have these, what do? Well, you don't send people away. The recommendation is still go ahead and vaccinate with any age appropriate influenza vaccine. But if you have one of these in stock, this is going to be the direction that you'll go.
Mm-hmm. So yes, that's an important point, is don't send them away, vaccinate with any age appropriate vaccine. So don't wait. So excellent. And one, let's try to get to a couple more questions. We had an audience question. Would you ever recommend two doses of flu vaccine for a patient, especially if a patient got their vaccine earlier in the summer? Lauren, would you want to take that question?
I can. I want to. So when you say two doses, I stop for a minute, because there are children less than 9 years of age when they're getting vaccinated for basically the first dose, or they haven't had yet two doses, then they do get two doses. I think it's 4 weeks apart. So that's a separate group, but it looks like what we're asking about here, again, if we had went ahead and vaccinated somebody in August, but maybe we shouldn't have because the CDC says to wait, should we do a booster? And no, we're not doing boosters. The hope is that this will carry them through our flu season. So we're not going to see a second flu shot being given to anybody. I think the exception might be if they're in the traveling to the southern hemisphere in their winter months over the summer, perhaps we'd consider something like that. But
that's a good point. I do want to answer this question, which also came up last season. We have so much interest in combination vaccines and a lot of questions about, we want a combo flu COVID vaccine. Will it be here this fall? Lauren, do you want to comment on the studies around the combo vaccines?
Yeah, this has been a hot topic, and I think we're all, I think, hopefully optimistic we'd have one this year, but I think we're still chasing COVID, right? And we're still seeing, you know, changes made to that vaccine, and, you know, we'll probably have the monovalent XBB as we go into the fall for that. And so I think because we haven't really been able to pinpoint the makeup of these COVID vaccines from year to year, it's challenging to then throw an influenza vaccine into the mix and have a combination product in the event that the COVID-19 vaccine needs to change. And so I think we're still in that holding pattern, just kind of watching how COVID plays out. But I do think we will see one eventually, because I think patients are kind of putting the two together when they think about the fall season and getting their flu shot, then they're going to go ahead and get their COVID-19 vaccine around the same time. And then you mentioned RSV. So I think it's hopeful, and studies are still ongoing looking at that.
Thank you. And yes, we're all just waiting. Like you said, hopefully optimistic. Andy, we have a hospital question for you. If a patient isn't sure they had the flu shot, should it be given during hospitalization anyway, or just to be sure they're covered, or should you dig a little deeper?
Yeah, there's no real benefit to getting a second shot, but if I really don't have great follow-up and I'm not sure, I'd rather them get it. The people that are leaving a system or really just don't have any great records that cross over, I will sometimes just make sure they have it.
Okay. Not necessarily harmful, but not helpful either if they haven't had one. Okay.
We hope you enjoyed and gained practical insights from listening into this discussion. Now that you've listened, pharmacists, physicians, and nurses can receive CE credit. Just log into your pharmacist letter or prescriber's letter account and look for the title of this podcast in the list of available CE courses. You'll also be able to access and print out additional materials on this topic, like charts and other quick reference tools from the Pharmacist Letter and Prescriber's Letter websites. If you're not yet a Pharmacist Letter or Prescriber's Letter subscriber, find out more about our product offerings at trchealthcare.com. Be sure to follow or subscribe, rate, and review this show in your favorite podcast app. It helps spread the word about our show and is a great way for you to let us know how we're doing. You can also reach out to provide feedback or make suggestions by emailing us at contactus@trchealthcare.com. Thanks for listening to Medication Talk.